So I think we're going to get started, if that's okay. You're here for an industry in transition session, which is hopefully going to be informative, but also interactive. So there will be sessions of us all working together. So we kind of moved the room a little bit, because I don't know if anyone was in this room before, but it was all the straight lines, which wasn't very nice. So at least we can see each other now, which is nicer. Okay, so what is this session about? Well, this session is a look at peak oil and what peak oil means, and then what it will actually mean to our industry. As I did say, it's an interactive session, so it's very much about everyone in the room thinking what their role is in the future of the industry and how different it might look with the onset of all sorts of environmental situations, including peak oil. So we're going to go through why the industry needs a transition, and we're also going to look at a framework that's being used in the UK at the moment called a Transition Town Framework. And we'll go through some elements of that framework. And the idea is that actually you'll all be able to go away, take these slides, and maybe redo this session in a smaller version with your colleagues or your MPI chapter or... So the aim is that this will be a useful thing for you to take away and put into practice. So throughout the whole session, just raise your hand if anything isn't clear. Yes, can you not hear me? I can turn me up. Okay, hold on. So throughout the session, if anything isn't clear, then do just raise your hand and let me know, because one of the challenges is that I speak on sustainability a lot and I'm familiar with the topics, and sometimes I can forget when things haven't been explained. So any question is a good question, and anyone putting their hand up and asking a comment is something that I will really appreciate. So please do that. Sound wise, am I better? Great. Okay, good. So how many people are familiar with peak oil? Just raise your hand if you've heard that term before. It's a term that is becoming more common, but not very much at the moment. So peak oil is the point at which the maximum rate of global petroleum extraction is reached, after which the rate of production enters decline. So to put it really simply, for the last 60 years, we haven't found any more places to get oil from in the earth. So 60 years ago, we were just taking oil out of the earth and it was a great resource, and then all of a sudden we haven't found any new places to take it from. And the places that we take it from now are harder for us to extract than they were previously. So we're using more oil and energy to get less back. So there's a problem here that we're needing more and more as our population grows and as we use more oil, but we're getting less and less out of the environment. There's a nice little film that I'll show you now, which kind of explains that in a visual term. So you can kind of see from that visual that we've had a situation where we've had loads of oil and our cars have kind of grown as we've had loads of oil, and now we're at our peak rate and no one's really talking about how we go downwards. So we could have a disaster where we go off the end, or we could actually plan to like head downwards. So that's what we're going to look at today. Just more research to back this up. You can see oil imports versus US production. So we've got here the production rates going down and the import rates going up, which also means that oil will increase in price. So again, for our industry, if oil increases in price, that's a challenge that we will all be facing. And then this is one of the most interesting things in the last few years. The big oil companies like Shell have now actually said, yes, we have reached peak oil. So it's now a recognised problem within the oil industries. So Shell estimates that after 2015, supplies of easy-to-access oil and gas will no longer keep up with demand. So the challenge that we have now is, obviously I'm not an oil expert, and I'm not going to go into all the different backgrounds of that, but we're working in an industry which is quite oil intensive, and there's lots of ways that we use oil. So one of the challenges we have now is thinking, where do we use oil and how can we change our way of working in the future? And there's a film here that we're going to look at now, and the quality of it isn't so great because it's come from YouTube, but this film is really looking at how the general public think they use oil and how that contributes to climate change.
What do we do that causes climate change?
Hang on, let me think.
I don't know what to say about that.
Driving cars.
Driving cars. Transport, I think, is probably one of the main ones.
Aeroplanes.
Cheap air flights. Easy jet.
Burning fossil fuels.
CO2 emissions from vehicles. Lots of electrical appliances. Electricity comes from power stations, which use fossil fuels.
Dishwashers. Washing machines. To clean the baby poo.
Cutting down trees hurts the planet.
You use energy and it causes carbon emissions, which causes global.
Not using renewable sources. Heat our houses too much.
Cow's bottoms.
It's all contributing to climate change.
I like global warming, it's free.
Gone blank.
Yeah. I think we've been lazy in the West.
In general, we're just too careless.
Lack of connection. Factory.
Aeroplanes.
Yes, aeroplanes, definitely bad.
4x4s, cars, aeroplanes, etc, etc.
That is producing huge amounts of carbon pollution, warming the planet, which is having a direct impact on all life on this planet.
It's going to heat up and dry out the central regions of this planet, which at the moment sustain the rainforests.
Climate change is having a very serious impact on the oceans.
Raising sea levels, far more frequent floods.
Lots of other effects, for instance, are the effects of insurance, subsidence, roads cracking up, rail lines buckling. I mean, it all sounds quite apocalyptic, but those things have started.
There's loads of things that we make using oil, like petrol, paint, pens, plastic, electric sockets, everything elastic, sunglasses, sellotape, sun cream and soap, rulers, radios and bits of old rope, all made using oil. Cars, carpets, computers and candles, hairspray, hoovers, hearing aids and handles, tires, TVs, telephones and toys, plastic hooters that make a funny noise, all made using oil. Wax, crayons, washing lines and wellies, glue, grease and petroleum jelly, fishing lines, fertilizer, fake fur and foam, makeup, medicines and mobile phones. Agriculture, building, transport, heating, cooking, driving, washing, flying.
So fossil fuels, they can't last forever. And experts are already saying that oil and gas are starting to decline. That with climate change is going to affect all of our lives. So if you want to know more about what you can do, check out transitiontowns.org/Lewis. It's a 10-year plan from Lewis and the surrounding area to adapt to climate change and our dependence on fossil fuels.
The launch is on the 24th of April at Lewis Town Hall. So come along and be part of the solution.
Okay, so the good news is we've done the most depressing bit now. We've gone through like all the graphs and all of that. So now it's all about what the future is for the industry and how the industry can change. And we're going to look at the transition town model that's been used in the UK and how that has made a difference. But first of all, the first like interactive thing is I thought if we could just take some time and maybe in groups, because we've got flip charts that we can use, just brainstorm exactly what you use oil for within your day-to-day event industry role. So should we take flip charts to the different groups, and then we can kind of just do two groups really. It's quite easy, there's not many. All your chairs are attached. That's the problem. Yeah. There you go. So someone can scribe. So all you need to do is just brainstorm where you use oil at the moment within the industry, within your jobs. Okay, so if we just wrap up now, and if we've got the microphone here, because this is being recorded, that's why we have to be so microphone focused. But if we just have a really quick summary of the two, from the two groups. So we've got, Rosa, do you want to take the microphone to this group? So just a quick summary of what you were writing. Yeah.
Can I? Is this working?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we thought that actually oil is probably in most of the things that are, you know, part of the events industry. The main thing really is transportation, how to get to events, you know, planes and driving and, you know, boats, trains. That's probably one of the big parts where we're using fuel as well. Any plastic-based products that we use in events, and we kind of detailed some, you know, the AV equipment, water bottles, water cups, bin bag, plastic cups, all these things that we use in events, badges as well. Energy consumptions as well in using hotels and conference centers, you know, so all the things that goes with heating, you know, all the different bills and utilities that goes into that as well uses fuel. The construction of hotels and conference centers as well, obviously there's a lot of plastic being used as well in that, and fuel being used in that. Also we talked about cleaning as well. So all the energy that's consumed, you know, when you clean the conference centres and the hotels. Uniform producing, the furniture as well. Obviously in here we can see there's a lot of plastic as well in here. In this room, for example, with all the chairs. And that's all we had
Brilliant.
So far.
So it's basically everywhere.
Yeah, kind of everywhere.
So then this group started like looking at solutions and other sort of issues. Do you want to kind of touch on those things rather than going through the list again? Heather, Simon?
We agreed that essentially, you know, the issues is everything. It's everywhere. The solutions we talked about was potentially a taxation, perhaps that, you know, government, greater government intervention that can be a deterrent for, yeah, continuing our behavior and status quo. Carbon offsets, but we also talked about the challenge around the lack of transparency. And that as a general issue in the entire subject of sustainability, really. And also, really, another issue of kind of the lack of integrity with some of the initiatives that, you know, are, it's almost, you know, greenwashing in the sense that, well, we start out saying that, well, sort your waste and put it in the recycling bin, but then it doesn't actually end up being recycled, you know. So, and then we talked about other solutions being using biogas and using other technologies like enzymes.
Yeah. Great, thank you. So there's quite a few bits and pieces like mentioned there. The taxation issue is something that we really could start to face within our industry, and now is a really good point for us to be thinking about this and thinking about what we can do as an industry to change and move forward and do things differently so that we're not just taxed, because otherwise there won't be much incentive to be creative and it could damage our industry significantly. Another thing to kind of think of when you try and talk to your colleagues about this and people say, oh, well, what does it mean and what is peak oil? There's something called energy slaves, which people talk about. And it's really thinking, if we didn't have oil and we didn't have machines and we were still using manpower, like human power, what would that actually look like? So an energy slave is the quantity of energy that replaces human labor. It takes 150 energy slaves per person per day in the US to maintain the current standard of living. So that's basically saying the average US person needs 150 energy slaves to do all the things that they need to do, like power their car, get their food production, power their TV. I don't know if you've seen any initiatives recently about bike power, where people have linked bikes up to TVs or heating things, and it's been like 30 people that have needed to cycle non-stop for an hour to power one TV and things like that. So this is something that's quite interesting. And one barrel of oil is 25,000 man hours of labor. So that's just a quirky way to think of it when you're explaining it to your colleagues at home. So the last film that we saw was a Transition Town film from Lewes, which is based in the UK. So we're just having sound problems. Okay, so the last film that we saw was a Transition Town one from Lewes, based in the UK. And the Transition Town came about when groups of people got together and said, look, we can see that we don't have enough oil. What are we going to do about that? And it was just average groups of people, nothing special kind of about them. And they got together and started looking in their local community at how they could grow more local food, for example. So Transition Towns started in the UK and are now spreading internationally. The UK government has looked at them and said, that's a great framework. How can we incorporate that into our government role? Because what they're doing is really interesting. And what we're going to start looking at now is some of the work that Transition Towns have done. And we're going to use a few of the frameworks for us as an industry to kind of start thinking about how our industry could be different. So we're going to look at a film now about Transition Towns in New Zealand, just to give you an idea of what that is. There's a few things in relation to the events industry which is quite interesting with Transition Towns, because right now their community is coming together to talk about how they live, but there's a massive program taking place for industry, because those communities are people who work in industry. They're corporate people, they're people that work for associations, that belong to associations. So there's a very significant rollout taking place for different industries, like the pharmaceutical sector, like the automobile sector, like the marketing sector, to look at transitioning using this similar framework. So although this film is very much about how communities have approached it, we should be thinking about this in terms of how industry could, and whether our clients could be involved in these projects at home and therefore bringing this into their workplace. The other really interesting thing about the Transition Town is how they use meetings to get to where they want to. So I don't know if it was clear on any of those screens, but they use open space. They use meetings where they bring different groups in that are the experts. So they'll bring children in to be experts for an hour, or they'll bring local farmers in to be experts for an hour. They'll use lots of different locations for meetings and different materials. So that's another way that really there's evidence that a meeting can, you know, make a difference, and that's the materials that they're using. So just at this point, any questions on the Transition Town framework so far, based on what you've seen? Okay. No? Okay. Does it make sense? Okay, great. So it's something that, has anyone heard of it before? No. Okay, it's worth having a look at, because you saw there the spread in New Zealand and the spread in the UK, and it is now very international, so you may get home and Google and find that there's a transition town very close to where you live. Yeah. Yes. Yes, they very much influence politicians, the transition towns, especially within the UK. One of the ways is because the members of transition towns are everyday people. Some of them are really quite important people who care about their local living space. And what's happened in the UK is that these communities have said, OK, we're going to do things like put an allotment in our local area so that we have local food for us. And then they say, where is our local area? Well, the only space that we have is on the graveyards. So in London, there's in, I think it's Wimbledon or around Clapham, there's graveyard spaces now which are allotments for growing food. So these transition towns have lobbied their local politicians, and it's now been recognised at an actual high government level within the UK, because these groups are doing things which the government are thinking, we should be doing that, how do we use that model? So it has quite a significant government connection within the UK, which means it will probably spread externally.
What's interesting is you say that the central government has taken an interest in this, but isn't the sociology behind that kind of against the whole idea about it in the first place, that it comes from within the community as opposed to being imposed by... Yeah. Legislation.
But the transition town framework is very clever, because they realise that the community can't do everything, and that change is needed, and that politicians kind of set rules and frameworks which are quite useful. So while the community is taking ownership for it, they're also reaching out to people like politicians to try and engage them. And if you think about it, that's what's so key for our industry to do as well. We don't really want politicians or taxes to tell us what to do. We want to say, as an industry, here is what we think we can do so that we still meet, so that we still have exhibitions, and this is the approach that we think works best, rather than someone saying, here's a tax on carbon or water or anything else like that. Okay, so what we're going to do now is just look at a couple of the steps from within the transition framework. Now, the transition framework takes over a year to take place. So we're just picking out some key steps here, which we can look at within the industry. And the work that's taking place with industry is tweaking the framework for each specific industry. So we're going to go straight to step five, which is really where you look at what could be different. So in the way that you live now, so if we think about our industry, how our industry runs now, and I've chosen four areas: food and beverage, transport, venue, and marketing. So based on what we do now, what could that look like in 10 years? So what I thought we could just do is, in the groups again, just draw some visuals or have a think about what one of these areas could look like in 10 years. So you can choose which one you want to do, if you want to use the same flip charts. Is that clear? Great. Go. Okay, so if we just pause there for a minute and think, we're talking about like what 10 years could look like in the future. So if we just pause there and think what 10 years looked like in the past, because sometimes this topic can sound a bit difficult and a bit depressing. But then if you look how much things have changed in the last 10 years, then loads of these weird and wacky ideas may well be possible. So I think some of the things that you were saying about 10 years in the industry, no electronic registration check-in, not much email, really dull presentations, lots of paper, long slides, sleeping delegates. Can anyone else remember anything 10 years ago that the industry was like that's dramatically, how it's dramatically changed now? Any other suggestions? Overhead projectors. Yeah, overhead projections. So go back to doing this and just think totally out of the box now, because just remember what that overhead projector and those slides used to look like. So Okay, great. So we're going to wrap up now. We're going to wrap up and ask the groups to kind of feed back in so that everyone can share that. So should we start with, we've got venue and we've got food and beverage. Do you want to go first, food and beverage? Okay, so food and beverage are going to share their vision for 10 years' time. Okay, so food and beverage are going to start, and then we'll come over to venue.
Okay, so we looked at the fact that meat, or eating meat, fish, everything else is not sustainable. So 10 years' time, we probably won't be eating it. Don't know whether that's realistic, but... and also glass bottles and such, they need to be, yeah, biodegradable or some kind of different way of housing your bottled water or not using it out of a tank, whatever. We also went again about the biodegradable side, so if it was something that has to be thrown away, what you could then do with that product to make sure that it could be used again rather than just be thrown away. So sort of meeting a pinnacle of biodegradability and recycling. Collecting, well, this is our whole house. This is my house. I would have my fruit and veg growing on the roof, of course. Solar panels, so that I can keep my house heated. So some kind of energy that is renewable. Sorry? Yes, but this is my house. So yeah, a conference centre, if we're putting it to the venue, so from a food and beverage perspective, so that they would grow things, and also from a green perspective, for the you know, if you can't have a forest on your roof, you can. There should have been a wind turbine up here too, but I missed that one out. The water being collected as well from the roof that you can then recycle and use through the toilets in most places in other countries. We don't necessarily do that in the UK. We are doing homebrew for our, so it's locally sourced because. We, at the moment, you import a lot. Part of our industry is a lot of food and beverage and lots of drink, and we need to be more realistic about where that comes from if we're going to cut down on transportation costs, and also food waste. So good old Excel, used to having their wormery mentioned, so we mentioned about more wormeries around the UK so people can actually use the food waste, put it into the wormery, and then create something good at the end.
Great, and actually that's not, all that stuff is not so far away, because a lot of the materials that biodegrade, there's a crisp packet that's just come out in North America that now can biodegrade in the ground. Coca-Cola are working on something similar. And then if you think of Vancouver Convention Centre, they've got their grass roofs, they've got beehives, because bees are slightly endangered, so a conference area is a great place, open space, on the roof they have the beehives. So if you go to WEC, you'll see those. And then one of the biggest new trends for the next year or so is actually what they're calling walled gardens. And it's about this big, and it fixes onto the side of your house. And you put plants in it, and they kind of grow out this way, so your herbs or whatever. So for people that live in apartments or wherever else and don't have much land space, the sale of walled gardens is apparently now the big thing. So great, and it's probably 10 years' time not going to be that take that long to get there. Venues?
Right. So we looked at the use of local renewable energy, use of renewable materials for construction, more efficient technology usage, and we were broad here, but it goes from any of the technology in the rooms to lighting and external devices brought maybe by the attendees. A zero waste target, the multifunctional purpose of venues with a community involvement, so beyond your cookie cutter standard conference, you would also have smaller micro venues taking place there to maximize the use of the venue. Limited use, or we actually went to no paper usage. So that ties in with the technology, but that's very important, because if we look in this room, the notebooks, the flip charts, use of local labor, local food production and supply, and the strategic location of venue to limit transportation and also to maximize time.
There's a really good thing on YouTube. I don't know what its title is. I think it's if you Google waste equals food, and it's a film by William McDonough, who's an architect, who's worked with businesses like General Motors and Ford to redo their factories so that they have more natural light coming in, so that they capture all their rainwater, so that they have a community place for people to meet. And it's looked at how that building has increased productivity within people. So I think the venue will become much more of something that's important to increase productivity and sales and everything else, rather than just being a building.
Actually, I just wanted to say that in the U.S. there is a higher use of, I can't remember what they're called, but you can have a hole dug through your ceiling and you have this lighting that's actually coming straight down through
like a skylight?
Yes, it's some form of skylight, and you can have it put in your kitchen and in your living room, so your electricity usage during the day is next to nil.
Great, good. Any questions or anything based on all of this? No? Okay. So the next one that we're going to look at is all about a step called honouring elders, and it's about making sure that we don't just forget everything that's gone before. We learn what worked, and we make sure that the same things that worked 10 years ago are still being used and they're not being lost. So Linda was just telling me before she was in a session where they had all the computers, but they couldn't type quick enough to keep up with all the questions. Whereas if you think shorthand 20 years ago, you would have been able to document that. So this is really making sure that it's not just about throwing everything out and starting again. It's about looking at what's been good and what has worked before. Then the next, step eight is what they call the great upskilling. And it's basically about the fact that it's too difficult for everybody to have to learn everything. So it's about sharing skill sets. And we kind of started off an exercise with that when you came in. So you wrote one skill which might help someone in their job. So there's a list there of skills that you're all good at in this room, which you could maybe swap skills with each other. And in the transition town process, you'd work hard to match people together. So if someone wanted to learn about Twitter, they could swap skills with a salesperson or something like that. The final part of the transition step is to create action plans. So we're just going to have a look at doing that. I thought we could look at doing an action plan for MPI, your association, and also an action plan for yourself. But I just wanted to kind of point out a few things, and these are visuals from the Vancouver Olympics, which has been the biggest meeting and event recently held and really did focus on sustainability. And it kind of shows some of the changes that can happen quite quickly. This here is Coke's merchandise, and they had a massive thing about recycling so that they could use it in their merchandise. So the majority of their clothing was made from their bottles. Not just that, but everywhere that you bought a Coke, there was a recycling bin next to where you were buying the Coke bottle from. And they were also creating the plant bottles. So that was really interesting to see the suppliers, the sponsors even, of this event really going after what sustainability was. And then this I thought was quite interesting at one of the venues, a food area, all compostable items, but not quite in the picture. There was just a sugar and a milk jug. So in a massive venue with thousands of people, they had this open food element, which a lot of people have always said, well, that'll never happen because people won't want to share sugar or pour milk or whatever. But it's interesting that that was actually happening within the Olympic venues. So that's quite interesting to see. Yeah, illegal, I know. So again, it's laws and differences. And people will always say, oh, but you can't do that. And that's why I thought it was really interesting at the Olympics, because maybe the Italian athletes didn't do it, but a rule that, yeah. And then this was one of the venues, and they actually, when everybody sat down, you can't really see it, but they had a whole sustainability film playing, And around the venues, they had sustainability messages saying, we've changed our energy source, we've saved this much money, we've had paperless offices for the back office staff, this is the amount of paper that we haven't used. So it really was part of the actual event. It wasn't something that was hidden, it was quite transparent. Now, they weren't perfect at all, but what they were trying to do was inspire and educate and make a difference with what they were doing there. So that was like the sustainability film that showed before all of the events. So everybody watching got to see that film and see how it had been done. Another interesting thing they did was measure the energy of all of their venues and then actually publicly say, this is what they were last year, this is what they are day by day. And that was available online and through their energy centres. So they really did go after the transparency. So what would be good to do now is to just spend some time working on an action plan. And what would be really great is if everyone thought of at least three things that they can take away from today. But I think the best way to start this is to try and do an action plan for maybe what MPI could do to tackle this subject in the future. And there's three things that I want to mention about the action plans, which three things that are really important. The first is training, because we've all come to this education session, great, but there's a lot of training and education that probably needs to take place within the event industry on this. There's some tools that will help you now. The whole concept of meeting architecture, the whole concept of having a room layout that works with you, that will support this. And then there's also the ISO 20121 framework. So that is a framework for implementing sustainability. It's ISO 20121 based on BS 8901. It's now going to be an international process. So that's a key framework to look at, to review, to try and get your teams using, and then they'll be much more educated and trained in this area. Technology, there's some great advances in technology coming. These measurement systems are on a room-by-room basis. You can now track your energy usage. You can get text messages saying that you've left lights on, all sorts of things. So energy is no longer going to be a difficult thing that we can't manage. There is technology. Again, the mobiles, the cars and the mobility stuff that they had for the games is really interesting. They used all sorts of different types of fuels. And they really had a lot of, in terms of transparency, a lot of communication around the recycling. Now, the big challenge was, although they communicated all of this for recycling, people were putting different things in different bins because the education level is not such that people really understood. So transparency-wise, their recycling rates would probably be terrible, but what they were trying to do was educate and move people forward. So maybe in 4 years' time at Sochi, if the same people go again, they'll know where to put their rubbish in different places maybe. Return on investment around sustainability is really important. And then there's also the GRI guidelines. Now, these are a framework for reporting specifically for the event industry on sustainability. So the big challenge we have right now around transparency and making sure, the key question that's come up is, how do you know if someone is being sustainable? And it really is by them reporting on why they're doing it. So a good example here was the boxes. Did you see the boxes at lunchtime that said sustainability? So lots of questions were, why are there boxes? Is it good to use the boxes to visualize sustainability? Maybe those boxes have a second use that we don't know about. If there was a transparent process, a transparent report, we would then know what was happening to those boxes. So the GRI guidelines are something to look for. They'll be taking place. There'll be public comment over summer on those guidelines. Okay, so for the next 10 minutes, if you want to in your groups, write an action plan in terms of 10 things which MPI should do to address peak oil and climate change. Yeah.
I mean, I know MPI wants obviously to be also very CSR conscious, and when they organize an event like EMEC or WEC, do they speak to the venue and say, this is what we want, and give them a brief? Because I think, like in the States, I attended the last two WEC, and I think they're very sustainable, much more so than the event we've had in Turin and here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the water bottles, I think it's an easy fix. You know, they just gave us those bottles and you just had no choice than to carry it around and, you know, refill it. And I thought that was very good.
Yeah, I do know the MPI do ask the venues and the host committees to be as sustainable as possible. Now, every different host committee has their different challenges. Mm. So here there might be a challenge around bottled water. Mm. Somewhere else there might be a challenge around something else. So.
It was just a comment because I just thought in the States they were very good at this actually in terms of being more sustainable, but I didn't know if it was the venues or MPI telling them.
I think it's both. The venues saying we want to do it and MPI saying we want you to do it. So, but an action plan of 10 things that you think MPI could do about the fact that peak oil and climate change is happening. And then what we can do is feed those action plans back in and hopefully from those action plans you can take away some things as well. So if you want to just work in your groups on those action plans. Okay, so that's great. So what we'll do with that is we'll photograph that and then feed that back in because I'm sure that will help MPI as well. And I just wanted to spend the last last 5 minutes going through the questions that you kind of raised, your main sustainability questions, to just see if I can kind of help with some of the input on the answers and then see if you have any other questions. So one of the main questions that came out was, how do you measure sustainability consistently? And who says what is sustainable and who says that's not sustainable? And the true answer is there isn't a magic list of what is sustainable and what is not sustainable because it depends on your situation, your destination, the numbers of your people. What there is two frameworks which are internationally recognized frameworks which, if you use them, will be very transparent. And one of those frameworks is ISO 2012-1 that helps you implement sustainability within your way of working. The other is the Global Reporting Initiative Framework, and that helps you report on what you've done. Now, both of these initiatives are still in development, and as the event industry, you have an opportunity to feed into these initiatives. So there's email addresses here of the two people if you want to be involved. If you email guidelines at Global Reporting with subscribe events in the title, you'll then be put on the practitioners network. So you'll receive an email when the draft reporting guideline has been created and you can give your feedback in. Then if you email Jose, he will be able to put you in contact with your country representative. Because with ISO 2012-1, all the different countries send people to the meetings and they have their own mirror committees where they will feedback what's happening around the development of this standard. And there'll also be a public comment period where you can comment on it. So although there is nothing that we can say that if you do X, Y, and Z, that is what you should do, what we can say is if you use these frameworks, they will help you be transparent. There's another initiative that's come out of North America, specifically for meetings, which is called APEX, which is a list of requirements for a meeting under the 9 sections of what a meeting contains, venue, food and beverage, etc. That's worth looking at and can be useful. It has been created for a more North American audience, so there is a challenge in that we have slightly older venues, so that might be a problem to use. That, but it's worth looking at because that gives you some guidelines on what to be measuring too. There was a question here about how to make sure that green is not just a trend and it becomes a strategy. And I think using the right language helps. So to talk about sustainability, which is economic, environmental and social, not just green, which is just the environmental part. And I think the pieces of work that we've been doing today and this work which will be fed back in is all about making sure that we become strategic with sustainability rather than just greenwashing. There are a few questions about costs, and in truth there are costs in relation to education. So in terms of educating your team so they know what to measure, so they know how to measure, so they know how to use these frameworks, those costs are completely unavoidable. Beyond that, however, there shouldn't be additional significant costs. It should just be about education and people becoming more aware about the choices that they're making. There was a question about where to start, and I think really today's session hopefully will have been useful, but also to look online about case studies And really, if you can just be trying to do one little thing at every event, it will make a difference. There's not enough research that has been done for this within our industry. There is not the information out there on if you turn your lights off, how much energy will you save at a conference? If you use bottled water, how much will you save? Because in truth, we haven't been measuring stuff over the last few years. So we can't say that's bad, and now this is what good looks like for a measurement. What we can all be doing, though, is we can all be starting to think about what we could measure. And if you use the GRI framework, it gives you ideas of what to measure. So even if at your next conference you just measure how many bottles of water you used, you'll then have an idea of what that benchmark is for that type of conference. The challenge we have with events is every event is different. So we can't really say measurement from this event should be related to this because they could be totally different. Any other questions that I haven't answered? Any questions for Heather?
I was just wanting to, it was more of a comment, because when you mentioned, you know, the cost issue and the need to, you know, measure and educate, thereby educate your supply chain,
yeah.
I mean, organized lists, that's something that you obviously work with and that you contract with people on.
Yeah.
Is this sort of, I mean... How substantial do you find the demand is out there amongst your clients to actually go into the supply chain and work with
yeah.
the supply chain?
So I think the question is, how much of the supply chain are kind of being educated? Is that kind of like the question? So as an example, we were working with Reed Exhibitions, and they did a piece of education for their supply chain, because they realized if they wanted to be sustainable, they wanted their supply chain to go through this education so that they would know what they were doing. There is a big demand for education around sustainability, and I think MPI is doing quite a lot to address that as well. So, yeah, there is a demand. I don't know if that... Does that answer your question, Heather? And I think also what we might see happening is that suppliers might come together, if you're using the same venues or the same contractors, maybe come together and say, you know, let's ask them all to get education. Maybe the CVBs will start providing education for people, or maybe like the local chapters at MPI will. There's lots of ways that education can be accessed. Well, yeah. Thanks,
I did some research with the European Wind Energy Association in November on their event in Marseille the previous April. And they've just started working with sustainability on their events, because they have to, because they're the European Wind Energy Association, and it makes perfect sense for them to do so. But I think what they found was that people were very, very willing to from the supplier point of view, their suppliers were very willing to adopt sustainability
yeah.
practices. They were just waiting for the start, basically. So the Marseille Convention Centre now has they have a combined waste facility with another local building, which is run by the same company. They have recycling is now standard with all their events, as is using recycled carpet. And now there's a hotel, the hotels now have created their own, in Marseille have created their own sustainability benchmarking regarding the use of towel policies and
yeah.
energy and all that stuff. And it's really a very good example of how when you ask for it, it
yeah.
will happen.
So there's kind of two things on that, really. When you ask for it, it definitely will happen. And what we're about to see is an explosion of people claiming that they're doing things. So that's the next step, because they want that encouragement, and then they'll start saying things. So then it's about making sure that they are educated and they are actually doing what they're saying that they're doing. The other thing to really realise is that this is a massive growth industry. Like, the solar is going to be a big growth area, wind is. These people are all going to need events. So So if you're a supplier to the event industry in any shape or form, if you're learning this now and implementing it, you're going to be in a better place to win business, significant business, over the next 5 or so years. Yeah.
The new international guideline, is that still based on triple bottom line principles?
Yes. So the ISO 2012-1 is based on the old 8901, which was based on all the materials that were out there when 8901 started. So it says anything that says sustainability is based on economic, social, and environmental. There is no... Yeah, the actual document, you do have to pay to get the document, and it's just like paying to buy a book. And really, the standards bodies, that's their income stream. So a lot of people get uncomfortable in terms of, oh, we have to pay to buy the standard, or, but it's about realizing that actually the standards bodies need to generate the income to if you get the event a third party certified, you have to pay a third party to come in. You don't need a third party, you can self-declare. So you can say, this event is self-declared, compliant, because here's our evidence. Now, what we're seeing at the moment is people self-declaring without the right evidence, but the more people learn about this, the more they'll realize. And as a supply chain, if you're saying to your suppliers, can you show me evidence that you've done this, that gets over that hurdle. Any other questions? Well, thanks so much for your contributions there. I hope that was useful. It's a lot to go through, and it's a challenging topic as well, so I do appreciate your input. Thanks.